Welcome to The Drill Down. We've got business stories behind stocks on the move. I'm Corey Johnson with episode number 189. Well, just ahead, rising expenses have Zions Bancorp worried. And we'll drill down into the oil business, looking at surging activity in LNG and a surprise pronouncement from Halliburton. And the big business of bringing high-quality drinking water and high profits one bottle at a time. Super slick interview with Primo Water CEO Tom Harrington. But first, sponsor time.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. Never miss another critical event or insight ever with Era. Customize your company watch list and track key events, mentions, filings, and more, all within an easy-to-use, customizable interface. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And you can listen to The Drill Down on any of your favorite podcast platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn included among those places you can listen to us. But you won't miss a single show if you hit the subscriber button and follow us.
And The Drill Down is brought to you by Brain Trust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Brain Trust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast at a fraction of the cost. Visit braintrust.com. That's BRAINTRUST.com to learn more.
I'm Corey Johnson. Welcome to The Drill Down. We're going to explain the business stories behind some wiggly lines on a chart.
Yay.
Helping me do that, as always, executive producer Isaac Webster. Isaac, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Things are drying out up here.
We are too. Finally. We are nice and dry down here. A perfect day for Primo Water to be our guest. Corey, what stocks are you drilling down on today?
I want to look at Zions Bancorp.
Trades under Zion, Z-I-O-N, and shares have risen 6% since the start of the year, 2023, but have fallen almost 18% if you're looking at a yearly chart.
So Zion's an interesting regional bank based out of Salt Lake. They own lots of different brands all over the country, predominantly in the West, a little bit in the Midwest. But an interesting company, not least of which, because they are sitting in this world right now where they're seeing difficult times. Now, the revenues were up in the quarter. They just reported $883 million in revenue. Net interest income, maybe a more important number for a bank, $720 million in the fourth quarter, up from $663 million the previous, or $553 million from a year ago. So income's going up, but originations look like they're slowing down. And the question is that because business activity is slowing down, or is it because rates are up and it's harder for certain companies or individuals to see a return on a loan when the rates are so much higher? I've always tended to be skeptical that higher rates really make businesses in particular make decisions saying, oh, you know, I wanted to build a new factory when interest rates were at 2%, but now they're at 4%. I don't want to build a factory. On the margin, I guess that happens. So the question here is what's it going to look like going forward? And the number that this bank uses, a lot of banks use, is the deposit beta, which is if we increase our deposits, what's the observed cycle going to be in terms of the beta versus their deposits and their ability to loan out and their costs related to that. And at 18%, it really shocked, I think, a lot of people on Wall Street who thought the number was going to be more like 5%, not least of which because the bank told us that. So here's Zions Bank CFO Paul Burdiss talking about the pressure they're seeing with higher rates and why they think that their deposit beta is going to be more like 18% instead of what they thought previously was going to be 5%.
Where we've seen the pressure is not necessarily on the rate, it's been in the volume, you know, which kind of implies that there's a rate element attached to that. The 18%, to be clear, while it's a very precise number, you know, as implied, that's sort of a modeled number based on our experience. And it's intended to capture sort of our best estimate of where deposit rates could be. But to your point, you know, this is kind of a day-by-day challenge. We're constantly managing the balance between the rate paid and maintenance of the very valuable deposit franchise on the balance sheet. So I would love to be able to tell you that it was, you know, very conservative or otherwise, but it's, you know, it's frankly, it's based on history and based on our models, it's our best estimate of where we think deposit rates are expected to go.
So bottom line, it's tougher times, Isaac, for Zions Bank to make the loans that grow their business. I think really it sounds like the dual threat of their higher interest rates, scaring away some customers, lower economic activity, scaring away some customers, and their rising expenses you know, adding to that, they're making their margins a little bit worse.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear such frank talk from Paul Burdiss right there. Corey, what is your next drill down?
Let's look at Baker Hughes.
Baker Hughes trades under BKR and shares have dropped over 5% over the past week, but they are higher by almost 11% if you're looking at a 12-month chart.
Well, and I wanted to do a dual look at the oil and gas business, which, as you know, fascinates me so very much. With Halliburton and Baker Hughes, companies that are often lumped in together because they both are in the oil field services business, but very different kind of companies. Baker Hughes, much more of a kind of consulting firm for, in particular, the sort of later aspects of refining oil and gas. And indeed, the big questions about LNG. With the war in Ukraine shutting down Russian gas and Russian oil supplies, it's really changed the consumption of liquid natural gas and long-term planning for liquid natural gas. And so there's some acronyms. It's oil and gas, so there's got to be some acronyms. FID, final investment decisions. When they plan these LNG facilities to essentially freeze the gas and then put it onto ships and then take it to an offtake facility, perhaps in Europe or somewhere else, the decision to actually go ahead with these projects comes after many years and thousands of hours of work in planning and designing these facilities. A lot of that work done by Baker Hughes. But the big money comes when the final investment decision happens. And the question ultimately is, how many MTPAs are they going to be able to crank out? That is the annual capacity of flow rates.
Yeah.
Million tons per annum.
Ah.
So how many millions of tons a year of liquid natural gas can these guys create? And in particular, is the Mideast, which has not been a huge player in LNG, what is the Mideast going to do in terms of capturing gas, putting in LNG facilities, and selling that gas? North America has been producing a lot of LNG. And so the question is, where are they going to do this? When are they going to get those final investment decisions, those FIDs? And when are they going to decide how many million tons per annum or MTPAs are they going to crank out? Here is Baker Hughes CEO Lorenzo Simonelli.
I can tell you the customer discussions have been remaining, and there's a lot of positive momentum. And I think both as you look at the near term and also the long term prospects for natural gas and LNG, it's a positive investment cycle. You know, in 2022, we did experience some cost inflation, some higher interest rates, which slowed the pace of FIDs. But conversations with customers definitely hasn't slowed down. And I think you've seen some of the announcements also within North America from Sempra related to Port Arthur, sure. Decade, which has signed up a supply agreement. So, you know, importantly, I think the operators globally have recalibrated the project costs to the current environment, and they're actually starting to see success in securing some of the offtake agreements. I think there's a realization out there as well that natural gas and LNG are going to play a key role, not just as transition, but also destination as the world continues to need more energy. And so we see a number of projects that are getting close to FID. We feel comfortable with at least 65 MTPA reaching FID this year and expect to see sanctioning activity actually exceed that. So it's not just about 2023. I think as we look at the environment right now, we're actually going beyond and seeing also 2024 and also 2025 with the portfolio we have of modular approaches, and a good time to be in LNG.
Don't you love that voice of Lorenzo?
Yeah, and I feel like we've been hearing so many bullish comments on LNG for a while, but we have never heard of
it. Right, but it's always around the bend. It's always in the future. It's always on the come. Mm-hmm. Finally, these things are really happening because the natural gas market has picked up in terms of prices, and the long-term effects of the war in Ukraine are having an impact, certainly in Europe, but really globally when it comes to LNG and LNG production.
Corey, what's your next drill down?
I want to look at Halliburton.
Halliburton trades under HAL, and shares have dropped 8% in a week, but Halliburton shares have risen 39% over the past 12 months. Pretty good investment in Halliburton stock if you were there for that.
Well, it's because the company's doing so well. I mean, they announced fourth quarter earnings where total revenue is up 30% to $5.6 billion, 30% year over year. It's just a fantastic quarter, although profits were down to $656 million, not unlike Baker Hughes. But as we, and there's lots of reasons for that, rising costs are a big part of that. But I think, once again, the question is, what's going to happen to the wells that have been drilled in North America where there's nothing coming out yet, where there is a completion that could be done, where there are drilled but uncompleted wells? That's right, a duck. Walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, but in oil and gas, if they talk about a duck, they're not talking about a duck. They're talking about a drilled but uncompleted well, DUC. And so those are wells where they've done the work. They found the oil and gas. They've drilled the well. They're at the platform, and they're saying, you know, it's not even worth it to take it out of the ground right now. Let's just cap this well, leave it uncompleted, even though it's been drilled, and we'll complete it later and get that oil and gas out of that well. Well, in North America, there are a lot of ducks. And getting those ducks in a row, like, see what I did there?
Walking those ducks in a row
and getting that oil and gas out of there could be a great big business for Halliburton and for others.
Now, well, it would be oil off a duck's back. Oil right off that duck's back.
Yes, it would. Now we can talk about Oregon football. But no, let us not do that. I think it's important right now to look at the expectations of the industry are that the ducks will remain uncompleted and that there won't be more rigs going up in North America. And yet the Halliburton CFO, Jeff Miller, says that's all wrong. And he thinks North America is going to surprise to the upside. Here's Jeff Miller.
North America is going to, in my view, will surprise to the upside. Our outlook is north of 15% growth. Clearly, we outpaced that last year, and that's what I said last year. I don't have any clients that are not, that plan to get smaller. They all plan to grow. And I think that, North America has a dynamic of the more you grow, the more the market has to work in order to maintain even the growth, given decline curves. And so, I expect we see increased service intensity throughout 23 and likely beyond. The market is extremely tight for frac equipment. And the supply chain still backed up. And so I don't see I see discipline in the marketplace, and more importantly, I see sort of required discipline based on equipment being unavailable. So the more activity we see, then ultimately the more price we will see. And so I am very positive on 23 North America. So I think the concerns are misplaced, and rig count likely moves up actually as ducks get blown down.
So Halliburton and CEO Jeff Miller making a big bet that the world's wrong, that they're right, and that was the bet they made last year, and that certainly worked out. That the world is wrong, that they are right, and they will see positive developments of ducks actually getting completed, but rig counts going up and more oil and gas coming out of North America, which is good news for Halliburton. All right, speaking of getting all wet, Primo Water. Really interesting business, delivering water to individuals and businesses, and a fantastically profitable, growing
and sustainable way.
And not just selling more stuff and not just making more money. Their EBITDA margins are really going through the roof here. Technology companies wish they could see more. Oil companies wish they could see margins like this. Primo Water's got them, and they're getting better. And the story is an interesting one. Primo Water CEO Tom Harrington joins us right after this.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Brain Trust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Brain Trust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast at a fraction of the cost. Visit braintrust.com, that's BRAINTRUST.com, to learn more.
Hey, welcome back to the Drill Down podcast. We are joined right now by Tom Harrington, who's the CEO of Primo Water. The artist currently known as Primo Water after a name change a few years back. Tom, glad to have you on. What an interesting business you guys have. It's more than just a water cooler business, although it is, in fact, a water cooler business. Yes?
It certainly is. And good morning and thanks for having me, Corey. We supply healthy hydration water in a number of different ways to consumers. It is a water cooler business. We refer to it as Water Direct. We also supply bottles to large retailers and DIY customers, where a customer, consumer, can bring their bottle, empty bottle, to the store location and exchange it for a full bottle. We also have a refill business. So we would have vending machines that dispense high-quality drinking water outside of retail locations across America, and in some cases, in the aisle inside a retail location. So we provide water in a number of different ways. And the best way to think about it is whenever, wherever, and however a consumer wants it, we'll try to provide it.
And to give our listeners an idea of the scope, you guys are doing about more than $2 billion top line, $2.2 billion top line of the trailing 12 months, and very profitably, 19% EBITDA margins. So it kills me when I, being here in Silicon Valley, and every once in a while, I look up at a company that's profitable, and then look at a company that's really, really profitable, such as yours.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We're fortunate to be in a category that has high consumer demand. And frankly, I'm privileged to lead a number of teammates that are really focused on the customer experience. So our revenues and our profitability is driven by that combination of what we call customer for life and a valuable, important associate experience, and bringing those two together, you know, to reach the consumer where they live.
I want to get back to the customer for life notion, because you guys do have some important metrics that I think are interesting. But take me back to a more macro level. What are the big drivers in the bottled water business?
So if you think about the tailwinds that we experience today, there's clearly a shift to healthy hydration. It was certainly going on before the pandemic, but I think accentuated as people became more concerned about their health and now taking actions to live a healthier lifestyle.
A move away from three sodas a day to six bottles of glasses of water, or a move away from the three martini lunch to water. I mean, what's the move?
Yeah, I don't know about the martinis, but certainly a move away from sugary drinks and shelf-stable juice, you know, sugary beverages, to really reduce the caloric intake. And then we've experienced the benefit of that growth as consumers look to us as a healthy alternative. And look, life is water. We'd like to make it primo. And that's really the connection. The other thing that helps us on the tailwind is, unfortunately, everybody's read about Flint, Michigan, or recently Jackson, Mississippi.
So, and I think we're going to read more about that with the flooding we've got here in California right now, and what that's exposing about water systems, or that's probably a second derivative story. And indeed, the Biden infrastructure plan, as that spending starts to come out, and we start to see how bad some of these water systems are that we didn't know about.
Yeah, I think, look, municipal water is largely good. There are instances where there's challenges, as an example in Flint and or Jackson. But I think consumers have growing concern about quality of that tap water, which has positioned us as an alternative when a consumer makes that choice. You know, clearly the U.S. government is making a plan to make investments there, but I think that's a rather long road. So we think this tailwind will be here for us for the foreseeable future.
And what are the demographics of your customers? Is it families who've got little kids and want to get those kids drinking water, or is it the millennial who's sweating it out at Barry's boot camp and trying to be ripped and healthy?
Yeah, interestingly enough, because we have multiple solutions, we actually appeal to a number of different consumer demographics. So we would certainly have baby boomers like myself, right? So I care about healthy hydration, as I'm a little bit older than the average bear. But we certainly, and we have plenty of families, you know, the typical married couple with two kids and moms and dads' concerns about providing their kids with the right hydration. And then as an example, our refill business is a lower socioeconomic scale because there's a real value equation on what you could acquire water for on a per gallon basis. So we really span the consumer marketplace, which I think supports some of our growth and our trajectory and some of our good profitability.
Talk to me about the Costco business. I have read about it and I still don't understand it.
Yeah, so we've had a relationship with Costco for a number of years. And if you went to a Costco, over the weekend, you would see our people set up with a table sharing what our product is and soliciting the Costco member to start the water service. It's not in every Costco every weekend, but you know, we would be in 55 or 60 Costcos on every weekend. And it's a way for us to solicit new customers. It's a way for Costco to offer a valued service to their members. So it works for us, it works for Costco, and frankly, it works for the members that start the service. So everybody wins in this equation.
How big is the business?
It's big. So
Go on.
We actually don't disclose the numbers, but it's a meaningful contributor to our future growth in terms of customer growth.
When you look at acquiring customers in that fashion, you know, is that a cheaper way to add customers, or is it, you know, you spend the money getting those customers because you got the person sitting at Costco and it takes you 2 or 3 years to break even on that customer because the customer acquisition cost of having that salesperson out there for a while, you know, eats up the profits you might gain from the customers they had?
Yeah, it's an efficient and effective way to acquire a new customer because they have such high traffic that I can sign up or solicit lots of new customers in one event. The Costco member typically stays with us longer than other customers. So we actually get a good customer lifetime value and a nice return. And frankly, our returns are much quicker than 3 years. You're on the order of 15 to 18 months on average.
And what are your other methodologies to add customers?
We benefit from owning a website called water.com. So it is a meaningful form of online and digital new customer solicitation. So that represents a good amount of our new customers. We also also use our regional brands. So brands like Alhambra in Northern California or Sparklets in Southern California. So consumers know who we are, and we will solicit them and transact through, you know, typical online marketing events.
We also spend a lot of money on search optimization?
Absolutely. SEO, SEM, we spend a fair bit of energy and investment there building that. We introduced a mobile app, an enhanced mobile app, My Water Plus, this past year. It gets solid ratings on both iOS and Android, which is a way for us to begin to digitize our relationship with consumers, which is about making it easy for them to do business with us. The app is one way. Water.com is another way. So there's lots of ways for existing customers and potential customers to interact with us and learn about our services.
It's very interesting. You talked about sort of customer retention and when your customers stay with you. Your customer retention numbers are given out in an annual basis. It's a little bit of a fact checking there. It seems to be annual. Sometimes other companies I've been involved with weren't always so clear about what those numbers meant. But those numbers are also big, something like 86%, and they seem to be trending higher.
That's correct. It's about roughly 86.5% and has remained pretty consistent over the course of the last year or two. And I think that's important because of, you know, all the impact consumers have had, one with the pandemic and two with inflation. So we've been able to have a very stable customer base as we work through the challenges, frankly, of the past year. So we're proud of that, but it's also a function of what those associates on the team do in terms of taking proper care of the customers we have. So if we give you good service, you'll continue to enjoy the benefits of the water and stay with us for a long time.
How long is a long time? Do you even know? I mean, you talked about how the Costco customer stays with you longer than the average customer. Have you been in that business long enough to know? And how do you know?
Yeah, so we obviously, you know, we will track, obviously not. We would track when a customer starts and when a customer leaves in real time. And our average customer in North America stays with us about 4.5 years.
Interesting. And how do you decide? Yeah, I saw you guys purchased Crystal Spring Water back in October, and it made me wonder what needs does your brand have? You mentioned the regional brands. how do you decide when a brand is worth buying, and how do you even start to value those things?
Well, our business is about customer density and route density. So in many cases, we'll look to acquire a local operator because we benefit from the overlap of that customer base on our existing infrastructure. And that's one of the ways we leverage operating margins over the long haul, right? Because that route density is one way to create profitability. So we will look for overlapping businesses in our footprint. DNA is in our M&A. We've done, you know, upwards of 125 or 130 small acquisitions over the last 6 or 8 years. So it's an important part of our growth story. And
so it's really in oil and gas, we'd call that when they do E&P work, when they're drilling, they call it infill. They kind of figure out the broadest parameters of what the well might be and where the reservoir might be. And then they infill with closer knit wells to try to get every last drop.
Yeah, it's a very similar strategy. We call them tuck-ins, but it's really the same idea. So I have an existing infrastructure, and I'll just put more customers on top of that, and then my routes get denser. I can give better service, and then that leads to longer customer lifetime value and, frankly, higher customer retention.
It strikes me that this really is similar to the soda business in that you've got distribution facilities full of lots of bottles that go onto trucks by guys that are going to lift these heavy things. And then they drive around and load them off the truck and get someone to sign off and get back in the truck and try to get the route done so they can get home with their wife and kids.
Correct. There are a lot of similarities. So it is, you know, production to distribution, distribution to customer. In our case, the bulk of our customers are homes and small offices. So that's the one difference from a Coke or a Pepsi, as an example, is I'll deliver right to your house.
Right.
I'll put the bottles in your garage if you want me to. And then our commercial business is not an office business. Think of it more a barbershop, dentist office, doctor office. It's a bigger piece of our commercial base, which makes us a little bit different than a typical beverage distributor.
Does that mean smaller trucks? Does that mean a higher cost of operation they might have in the soda business?
No, it's we would operate. Soda.
Let me translate for the Midwesterners. That's pop. In the Midwest, yeah. You call it pop. The rest of us call it soda.
Soda or pop, right? Actually, the trucks are similarly sized, and because we want as many bottles on that truck as we can get, and while it would feel like more cost, it's not, because we have such great density. So if I was in a neighborhood in Los Angeles, I might park the truck once and service 6 or 8 customers. So it really is about enough bottles to satisfy the customer and drive less, deliver more.
And you must be benefiting from the reduction in fuel prices, which is to say, 9 months ago, you were probably hurting from the increase in fuel prices.
Correct. Although diesel, unleaded, has obviously come down pretty significantly in the last months. Diesel has been a little more resistant in terms of price decline versus, it was a year ago. So.
And yet the profitability has continued for your company. You've done quite well through this.
That's correct. Look, we've exhibited good price elasticity. So if you give good service, you have a high-quality product that consumers want, we've been able to pass through pricing to offset the impact of inflation.
And well, you probably will keep those prices there if inflation recedes, as inflation recedes, I should say.
That would be correct.
That would be good for you. let me also ask, where we think of geopolitical matters, you guys have seen an interesting benefit, or are starting to see an interesting benefit, from reduction of tariffs, that there was a tariff attached to, I guess, the machines that go into homes and businesses?
Right. So there was a tariff on dispensers imported from China. And our largest supplier of dispensers or coolers is in China. So that tariff was put in place in January of 22, and it was recently changed and eliminated effective November 6th. So it was a headwind for us in 22. It'll be a tailwind us in 23.
It was a big number.
Yeah, it's roughly $16 million on an annualized basis.
Put another way, I think it was something like $125 per unit. Is that right? Which is about 100% of the cost.
So think about if pre-tariff, I could sell a dispenser for $100. I now have to sell it at least $125. So it was pretty significant inflation. It's in a world of rising inflation. By the end of 23, these dispenses will be lower. It will actually be the one item that's deflationary in an inflationary environment, because that we will pass that price back through to our customers.
So that comes down by about 20% after the tariffs.
Correct.
Well, that's good news for the customer. Imagine that. So for you, the game changer is what? More infill acquisitions? It's slow and steady growth as customer preferences change away from sodas and three martini lunches towards healthier water?
Yeah, look, I think the tailwinds will continue to be consumer concern about healthy hydration and water infrastructure. We're in a great place for that. I believe we'll benefit from that in the long haul. Our growth will come organically. Our current targets are high single digits. And we believe that'll come from as consumers consume more and we continue to solicit customers through things like the Costco agreement, as well as providing great service. When you put the three of those factors together, we're confident in our growth story.
All right. Tom Harrington, the CEO of Primo Water. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Corey. Have a great day. Stay hydrated.
Coming up next. Yeah, of course. Gots to. Coming up next, we're going to have a wet bite. Not just because it's dumping rain in Northern California, but because it's about Primo Water, one number that tells us a whole lot right after this.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. With Era, give yourself an information advantage. Connect directly to earnings calls and other investor events with live transcription and event intelligence. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And there are so many ways to listen to the Drill Down podcast. You can listen to us on Spotify, iTunes, iHeart, Google Play, you name it. In fact, you could listen to us on all of those things. It might give us an artificial boost in listener numbers. That wouldn't be good. But nonetheless, listen to us as often as you can by clicking the subscribe button. Follow us and catch every show.
And let us know what companies you think we should be drilling down on. Talk to us on Twitter and Instagram by following at DrillDownPod and connect with us directly at our website, bizpod.net.
We're back with the Drill Down Bite, the one number that tells us a whole lot about Primo Water. Isaac, one of the important metrics, arguably the most important metric for this company, is growing over the last, let's call it 5 years, at a 43% clip, 43%. Is your bite. You want to guess what metric that is?
43%. I mean, customer. Oh God, I have no idea. Customer so growth.
here I am saying it's the most important metric.
It's such a huge number.
It's the profit margin. So the profit margins are at 18.9%, which is fantastic. Yeah. But the growth in those profit margins, it bumps up a little down, up and down every few quarters. There's a little bit of seasonality, it looks like, in this business. It's a little more profitable towards the end of the year. But the trailing 12-month EBITDA margin, which is 18.9% in the quarter they just last reported, 5 years ago, that number was more like 13.5%. So profit margins, EBITDA margins growing really consistently for this, to me, surprisingly interesting business.
Water's the new gold.
Let's not get crazy here.
I guess Primo already knew that.
Ether was the new gold.
Oh, yeah.
Or is that the old gold?
There's lots of new golds out there.
You guys are very healthy in your household. Are you straight out of the tap? Drink out of the hose?
We drink tap water, yeah.
Now that the Los Angeles River is flowing, you just send the kids down there with a big cup?
Yeah. You know, we have our bucket system.
No, you don't. All right. Well, we're glad everyone's chipping in here by listening to the Drill Down podcast, by paying great attention to our supporters and advertisers. We're grateful for all of that support. I'm Corey Johnson. Isaac Webster is our executive producer, and Ben Wilson stitches this all together as our editor extraordinaire. The Drill Down's a production of the Business Podcast Network.